We're snorting cap rates and shooting up cash flow here at Deal Junkie. Welcome back to Deal Junkies. We are back in the studio with Mark Gallegos today. We're going to talk. He's going to tell us how to never lose money on a deal ever again. This is an episode you cannot miss. I'm here with Mike Nuss, Trevor Howard, Dane McKinney. I'm Gabe Johansson. Thanks again, Mark, for joining us. You having fun yet?
Yes.
You like this? We're just going to stop doing deals and just sit in this room
podcast
every day, all day, just talk about real estate. Like you said, people like to talk about real estate. Okay, Mark, these guys want to grill you on some stuff, and we want to hear about some of the deals you've actually done. And maybe we can pull some pearls of wisdom out of what you have to share this morning. So, talk a little bit about maybe a deal that has had a lot of impact on you, or, that you learned a lot of lessons from, and how that, kind of propelled you into, your hyper growth phase.
Yeah, that's, something I think about quite a bit actually, because there's a few of those pivotal deals in a career that you think back and you're like, man, if that wouldn't have happened, I don't know what would have changed my trajectory. So early on, I had a couple good projects, a couple flips and single family stuff. And then there was a time where I was doing direct mail. So that was back when I always think about this, like when, if people were to say, is it easier to do deals now or then? And I really feel like it's the exact same. And this was 2017, and I was spending every dollar I had on direct mail. And back then, people were like, "Oh, it doesn't work."
You know? What was it? A letter or a postcard?
Yeah, I bought this subscription to do my handwritten letters,
mm-hmm.
where I do a mail merger with the name and the address. But it was my handwritten.
It looked like you handwrote a note to him.
Well, somebody did. So I'd get the letters back that were handwritten.
Oh, it wasn't a software program. It was actually handwritten.
Yeah, and they'd go out, and it was $1,000 a month, and it was pretty expensive for me back then. And it worked awesome. So at one moment, I got this bundle of 5 duplexes that were awesome, and those are the ones I bought 2 and wholesaled 3. And then I was completely out of money. I mean, reserves for the bank at that point, because I was doing my own loans. And it was, because you had to have, I remember the calculation of your principal payment.
A year's worth of payments or something.
And I didn't have it. And I had to sell stuff on eBay, and I had to get these bank statements to land on the exact date and then print them off, and barely made it for reserves on the refi. And I bought those with private money, with knowing I could do a rate and term on one. I was going to do a cash out later on those. So got those taken down, and then no money. And then a letter popped, and the guy was like, "Hey, my deal fell through. I'd love to sell to you." And I was like, "Okay, where's your project?" And he was like, "Oh, it's off April Street in Northeast Salem." What is it? Because I had my list. I was just mailing to my list. So I knew if it was on this call.
And you're targeting local?
Yeah. Okay. And I knew the equity position and the size and everything. So I knew if the phone rang, it was a good deal. So he told me the project in the area, and I was like, "Okay, where are you? Can I come meet you?" And he was like, "Oh, I'm headed back to my house." And he was a really old time guy. And so I'm driving from Corvallis, because I was still at work when this happened. So I'm driving from Corvallis. And I finally get him to say, "I just want 165 for this duplex." And I was like, "Huh." And he's like, "Yeah, I built it. I actually built the whole street." And I was like, "Whoa." And I was like, "Can we meet for dinner tonight?" And he's like, "Sure." So I meet him at the Sandyam Golf Course, right on Golf Club Road in Staten. And he's like, "Yeah, I'm kind of older guy. You'll see me." And he's standing there in a cane, and I go to shake his hand, and I'll never forget this. He had 2 fingers total. Mm-hmm. Between the whole hand. So I'm like trying to shake his hand. He's 96 years old in a cane. And he was just this hilarious old timer. And I sit down, and he's like, "Yeah, I want 165 for it." And on the way there, I drove by it. So I knew the exterior. And I was like, "Okay, let's do the deal. Do you think you want to carry the contract on it?" And he's like, "Yeah." So it was 10% down, and I still have the photo of the napkin we did on the table.
Yeah,
with this guy,
a napkin deal.
He spelt my name wrong, Mark with the C. 165, 10% down, 12-month balloon, and I just, it was like the perfect deal. It was like the story deal. So I me and my wife had a trip the next day. So we get back, and my wife and I go to tour this place, and he was like, "Beware, one of these is really bad." And I was like, "Okay." But I knew my numbers. I knew it was going to be worth like 250 at least. And so duplex with single car garages on each side, kind of an L shape, good separation, good lot. And we get in there, and the old guy hadn't been in there in 30 years because he was so old. He couldn't get up the first step, like a little tiny step. So we get in there. All the windows are blanketed, tacked up, and no furniture in there, just a lawn chair. And this drug addict guy was sitting in the lawn chair, and it was the creepiest moment ever. Like, so dark. And those houses didn't have lights in the living rooms, you know?
Yeah.
They're the lamp.
Yeah.
Flip
switch. Yeah, to plug it into the wall, yeah. Hit the
so
switch.
So no light.
And yeah. No, he put blankets on the window so you couldn't see in. So we go in the bathroom, and the toilet is literally falling through the floor with just looking at it. Like, it is tilted down in the joist. No shower curtain. He had just never used a shower curtain.
And no. Never mopped up the water after he got out.
No, and the Mountain Dew boxes everywhere. It was so memorable. I'll just never forget the visual. So my wife walked out of there, and she's like, "We can't buy that." And I was like, "No, this is the one. Like, this is what I've been dreaming of. Like, this thing is ready to go." And she tried to talk me out of it for so long, and I just kept showing her the numbers, and I just knew it was a no-brainer deal. So we walked the other side, not as bad, but pretty bad. And I hired a property manager to get both of those tenants out, and we flipped it for like 17 grand each side, something like that. And I was doing it, the whole thing, down to the studs, fixed the joists and new drywall, because it had wood paneling and just a bunch of stuff. The roof was fine, the siding was good, but changed the windows. And then I think I did a cash out in like 6 months and a day, like right on the dot, for like 380 or something, and took all the money out. And it was just that moment I knew, like, the
formula. So you were all in, though. You had about 50K of your own money in. If you're renovating, your scope is 17K aside, 10% down. So you got your 50 back plus your profit. You were able to.
Yeah, but I had to pay for that as I went. So like, we started the eviction process. A couple months later, I was saving up money from doing the loans, and I was just like barely covering it every month on the credit card, every month. It was so tight. It was painful, but it worked perfectly. And I was, because I knew I had enough time on the seller carry too. It was IO at like 4% or something too. So it was awesome. So I cashed out all that money, and I was like, I'm ready to go. Like, this was.
So it worked.
It worked.
What'd your wife say?
After that, she didn't bug me. It was like.
Does she still go to inspections with you?
Oh no, she doesn't even know
that. Oh, that was the one you said, honey, it's gonna work. Yeah. No, don't buy that one. Yeah. And it worked. So now she trusts you. Now she doesn't go find.
I guess that's true. Yeah.
All right, you proved it.
When you wrote it up on the napkin, did you take that to escrow, and that was your real contract?
No, I took that and I wrote up a real one and then had him sign it. But I have that picture. I want to show you guys it at some point. But it's.
You both signed it on the napkin.
Yeah. You should frame
Dave,
that.
Dave DeLapp. Was his name. I'll never forget him. I mean, the two finger thing really threw me off. On
how did he write? His other hand?
He ate the sandwich that night. That was what.
Wow. How much for him was it about literally writing it on the napkin?
It was, he saw me and him, you know?
Oh my God, I say that all the time. You come across the seller that sees you in them.
We became friends. And when I delivered him the real contract that I signed up, he gave me a book that he wrote about all his real estate and how he lost the hand.
No way.
So it was a whole thing.
How'd he lose it?
Yeah. In a tractor accident.
Working on one of his properties or what? Like,
he was an awesome, awesome guy. Lived in Lyons. Yeah, I'll never forget.
He was out on the excavator one day.
The PTO got him. Dangerous. Ooh. So that was a really neat deal that, you know, the tenant that, not the first guy, he was crazy. The second lady, when I gave her the notice, the first one was done, the drug addict guy. So she came over to his side, and she is still there now.
Rented his unit?
Yeah. And that was 2017. Still there. She sends me Christmas cards every year. I gave her a Christmas card a couple years ago and brought her to tears. And like, just the whole thing, like, it can be that way. Like, it doesn't have to be cutthroat, you know? she is in tears every time I see her. Like, it's just a.
So you still own that duplex?
Yeah. No, sold it.
Oh, you sold it.
Yeah.
But you still mail Christmas cards.
That was one of the painful 1031s. But I sold it to get into the Monmouth development.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Can you, okay, so you're a freaking rock star operator. So you've got a job, you do your own marketing, you're doing your own rehabs, you're negotiating with your sellers. Where did you get your negotiation skills? So direct to seller is, in my opinion, the best way to buy real estate. It does take a level of people personism, mm-hmm. people person skills. And then you have to combine people person skills, building a rapport to actually negotiate mm-hmm. to a deal. How did you learn that?
So I think necessity from underwriting. So it starts with your number, right? If you have your number in mind and you approach somebody and you just explain to them, you know, from flipping too, flipping really helped mm-hmm. because it's so black and white. You're just like, this deal does not make sense at your number. Here's how much it's going to cost to fix it. Go at it. Like, you flip it if you want. Like, you turn the tables a bit and they're like, oh, I see it. Like, you have a business, you need to make the numbers work. And so that really helped, just making it black and white and just trying to help people get out of their problem too. Like, it's a problem for them in some way. And so spending the time to understand their situation, talk through it, be patient. But I was kind of mentioning to you off air, like, I'm not that chatty of a guy. I'm not super outgoing. And so it took a while with the mortgage sales to like get familiar with hard conversations and get familiar with, hey, your rate's not this now. Like, when we pre-qualified you, like, you can't afford that house now. Just those little things that you get better at, like dropping the news or whatever. And so just trying to make a friend, like Gabe mentioned, you know, that Dave DeLapp guy bought it for 165, sold it for 500 a couple years later. And I'm sure he would be fine with that.
Yeah.
You know,
you sold it for 500.
500.
Yeah. Yeah.
And took two refis out of it. And I wish I wouldn't have sold, because the latest one was like 2.875.
Which two fingers did he still have?
Just his right, those two. And so he'd eat like—
Oh, thumb and forefinger? Oh, you can eat a sandwich like that.
No, it looked—
A small one.
Looked super odd. And the handshake was crazy, yeah.
How long did he give you on the seller carry terms?
12 months.
Okay, because I was going to say 96-year-old giving you a seller carry, that's pretty rare. Mm-hmm. They usually— It's past the point of seller 12, carry.
Well, how long?
12 months.
12 months. So it was very short term. You had to know your model was going to work. Did you have any sort of backup plan if you couldn't get him paid off in 12 months? Like interest rate goes up, or I can get an extension if needed?
The risk that I had was it wasn't going to be financeable if I was midway through, mm-hmm. but I knew the value was there. I knew it was worth $250.
You're ripping it.
Yeah.
You knew it.
Yeah.
And it came off of a letter that somebody else wrote that you were paying $1,000 a month for mm-hmm. in
2017.
Well, that was 7 years ago. So you're 24 years old at that time, your Dane's age.
Yeah, that was— so I went that year, I went from one project that I was holding, the rest were flipped. So I had one under like my long-term hold. And then I bought those two duplexes and that third duplex from that guy all in the same month. And it was rocked my world. I remember I had this like skin infection breakout because I was so stressed. I mean, I had no money. Like mm-hmm. it was—
Dude, I just asked money. You on the last episode about your most stressful time. And you're like—
I forgot.
I don't really have
much. Bringing it back. He blocked it out until now. Now you're breaking it.
And now you're telling me you were month to month on a credit card trying to— That's what I want to hear about.
I mean, I don't even remember it. That's what's so weird.
His eye almost fell out.
Yeah.
He broke out in a rash.
Full rash. And
it's like something about Mary. He just breaks out in hives.
And then I'm trying to do my day job too. So I guess that's a good part of doing a lot of hard stuff. That's— you just good. Like forget about the pain. You just keep going.
So it was painful. So we're learning from Mark now that you can lose money on a deal. You just have to forget about it. So when you go on a podcast, you'd be like, nah, it's cool. I always sleep. I always sleep good.
Nothing. It's all lukewarm at worst.
So what made you stressed was— you overinvested? You bought too many deals at once? What was the—
No, it was physical. The numbers were there. I knew without a doubt it was going to work.
So you weren't worried about money. You didn't have cash. You knew you were building a substantial amount of equity, but you were just in the weeds doing everything, working 24/7.
Literally, yeah. And that was it. Like the numbers, I knew they would work out. Our expenses were nothing at the moment. And I just— it was just a pure hours in the day thing, and I was exhausted. And so that wore me out, but it didn't really— I didn't think.
You didn't have kids at this point.
No. That was a huge part of it. Like we designed, I just kept telling my wife, we have to build this up before we have kids. I know me and I know how hard I want this and bad, and I'm just going to go as hard as I can. And so that was a big part, is like making sure she's willing for the, you know, set the expectation that I'm going to work all the time until this is built. And so during that time is when I took down that other project, and that I replaced my income around that point from the loans, because at the loans I was only making like I remember I made like $3,000 my first full year of commissions, and then it was like
$3,000 in the whole year
from July the first year. That's pretty good. From the July that I got licensed till the end of the year was $3,000.
Nobody listening to this is ever going to become a lender now.
That's back
$3,000.
Loan average was like 130.
Walmart's hiring.
So, I know. So then I went to maybe $40,000, $48,000.
In your second year, third year?
Yeah.
Now, you're making $4,000 a month. Yeah.
So I just knew I just got to get this many projects and I'm.
So you're in your mid-20s, you're newly married, you don't have kids, you have a skin disease, and you decide you're going to go run all these expenses up on a credit card knowing that your numbers work. You're convicted in your underwrite. You know that this is going to work.
Wait, how do you have enough? So you were slapping all your expenses on a credit card when you're doing all these?
No, it was just carrying their materials on the rehab.
Because you didn't have that much money then at this time.
No, not at all. Well, my wife had a job. She had a normal paying job, like $22 an hour. Like these is funny.
She's holding this all together.
Yeah.
No wonder she went to the inspection with you.
Yeah. She's cutting the check. So that whole thing about as your income ramps up, like keeping your expenses the same and all that, like that was absolutely the case for a very long time. And it's possible. I mean, she was making low 20s an hour.
So you grew up in a very frugal home. And so you knew how to live like that. And so you're saying, I mean, I think this is really inspiring to people listening, because, you know, a lot of people think that you have to have money to make money, and you gotta, you gotta know somebody to get into real estate, or you gotta take on the partners. You didn't have partners. Mm-mm. You didn't have any money. You're making very little amount of income. You're running things on a credit card, but you did invest in yourself and learn how to underwrite a deal, and you knew what a deal was, and you hunted for a deal and worked your tail off until you found the right deal. When the right deal presented itself, you were all in and you were willing to take that. I mean, it is, we say you're very risk averse. It feels like you're risk averse, but really that's a lot of risk.
I mean, part of that too, and I didn't communicate it that well, but when I did those 5 duplexes, I wholesaled all 3 of those at the same time.
So
that
from Dave DeLapp.
No,
same
previous. The previous.
Oh, the previous.
That was
deal.
Like 2 weeks before Dave entered the picture.
I see. So you were rolling in it. You were making a little bit of money.
No, I mean that I made more on those deals than I did for the year doing loans. So it was.
But
like,
you did have a cash infusion from those wholesales, helped you take down the other ones with private capital, take down Dave's, renovate Dave's.
Mm-hmm. You had built a little war chest.
Yeah.
Right.
But it was
right
gone,
in there.
Like that. And so I knew the math though, that, okay, I can get us started. I just got to carry the rest on the credit card. I'll have the cash out coming in. And it was calculated, but it was, I was making more on my wholesale flipping than I was doing the mortgages by a lot.
It's interesting you kept the mortgage job.
For a long time.
I would say, it's a total guess, an assumption, but that's probably served you with where you're at now, where wholesaling wouldn't have, because of the finance level conversation that you're having. Mm-hmm. If you don't get out of that wholesale world, out of an all cash transaction, and having finance conversations about long-term debt and understanding the finance world probably doesn't serve you the way it does today.
Well, when I was wholesaling, I'd package up a deal and say, here's the refinance, here's the items needed, I got your loan. So it's the full package. And
so the $40,000 you made was off your wholesales on the back end doing—
It was all full circle, and I'd be the property manager too. So like it was all this, and that was a tricky part, because the clients I would market to, it'd be this funny like, oh yeah, I do the home loan, but if you need property management, or if you are interested in investing, or you want to lend money, like I'll do the whole thing. I'd see these really well qualified borrowers and I'd like solicit them, but it was, I loved it. A lot of my clients are clients that I did loans for. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the clients, we were like 85% refinance. So these guys, I knew their picture, I knew their goals, and I just say, hey, you know, and trust me, like, do you want to lend on our deals? I've had a lot of my clients fund some of our projects.
Yeah. And that's the fun part of real estate, is it literally is a game. It's just teamwork. Mm-hmm. And you just add more players to the field.
Yeah. super fun. So yeah, that was a stressful time, but I don't think about it that much now. I've had way harder stuff now. Like thinking through on the Fisher Park project, that was a big jump. You know, going from value add apartments, starting to get in apartments, and then trying to take down, you know, $7.8 million project.
So Fisher Park, tell us a little bit. It's 26 units, mm-hmm. Salem, new build. You guys brought that out of the ground in like 9 months, 10 months, something like that. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was stabilized in, I think, just shy of 11 months. And it's big, too. There's storage complex on site. The unit average is like 1175. Really comfortable homes, spaces for them. And that project, I learned a lot. You know, it felt like I was kind of in that phase of like, everything I touch is gold. Everything's fine. I got the reserves. I was making a great living on mortgages and doing everything still. It's like, I'm ready. And then rates just whacked me. And so I was like, okay, now what? And so negotiating with the lender on that, we went straight. And that was part of my skill sets too, like doing the home loans. I knew just enough to be dangerous with the commercial brokers. So I'd get the package figured out, and rates got us, and then started raising money, found an SEC attorney, like did the whole thing by the book, and learned a lot in that phase. And it was so hard because July is when our permits were approved. And that's when our appraisal came in June and basically forced our debt service. So like we had to bring in that extra million at that point. It's like, okay, I'll go find the money, found the money. And then the lender was just dragging their feet. And I'm like, I'm missing my season. And I was just so out of control out of it. And it was different for me. Because the value
missing your season, you mean to get it built
mm-hmm.
for lease up in the right time frame.
And value add is you're in control. At least the projects I was doing, I had full control. Like I'd get the tenants out and I'm driving this timeline.
Right.
And I wasn't. And it was very, very stressful. And so everything came down to the wire. But by the time we started that one, we hit the ground running. So we went and sourced a construction to perm loan. You know, we could have financed that way more leverage, but I just said, this is what I'm used to. You know, let's just make it super conservative, hit our numbers. Like we could probably find more leverage in the private markets or something, but we had a local lender that believed in us and our, you know, team. Like our team was compartmentalized. Everyone had success in their own fields.
Right.
But they're like, so what have Skyline built? And they're like,
nothing.
I'll show you what Sam built. Like we had stuff, but it wasn't $8 million stuff. Yeah. And so
you got to convince them you're ready for a big deal. Well, we got the right partners. Yeah. We got the right team.
So sadly, I had to take two lenders to the finish line because I just didn't trust that it was going to go. So it was took a little bit of work. And
there's an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm.
Buy two appraisals. Put all your deposits, do your phase one with two groups and get work
docks.
Them both simultaneously. Docks, two sets of docks.
That wasn't
and get to the
deal.
Closing table and go.
And it's not advisable really, but I had to.
For safety, you're talking about pulling levers.
Well,
there's a lever. We've got two loans to pick from at the closing table.
And this is July 22. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's what you do.
The world's changing.
Yeah.
The world's changing.
You just cover
quickly.
Your ass.
Yeah.
That was just smart.
So that was pretty dramatic, but we got it. I mean, the funding was there. Like it was a no-brainer project. Everybody believed in it. It was just the concepts of first big commercial loan was construction.
Am I hearing you decided to go with a construction perm loan? So it's that debt coverage ratio on the perm that kept your LTV.
Mm-hmm. Praised lower a little lighter than I wanted. Okay.
So that actually makes them better because now you're bringing in more liquidity through your funding, your syndication.
And what I did is that was the first time I was introduced to it, but an earnout. So mm-hmm. saying, hey, I'm saying it's this, you're saying it's this. If it's mine, give me that money back.
Yeah.
It underwrote to the conservative. So I like that model a lot. And I think if you have investors that are prepared for these heavy equity deals, all it does is just help you. Like it's just... It's a better package for everybody, I think, you know, more conservative, longer term hold. But if your deal is try to get it in and get out, it's a different lending product.
You know, I had that epiphany like within the past month or so. Forever, I was just underwriting everything as a BRRRR model or a flip. It's get out, get your cash back. Mm-hmm. And everything's modeled on a cash back model, which is great because that's mm-hmm. ultimately no skin in the game. That's where you get scale. But when I started looking at and started underwriting and then partnering on deals where the whole play is leaving equity in, That changes everything on how you can underwrite, the type of financing you get, your timelines, the rehab plan. Your entire model can change when you bring capital that stays in the deal and you don't have to refinance it out.
Mm-hmm. And as a, you know, investment firm that's targeting investors, it's like, if you're targeting investors that can only do the deal if they need their money in 12 months, that becomes very painful for everybody. And so if you're in, going to people that are like, I'll give you 100, like, it'll be fine. They don't really need the money. And so it creates that avatar of your ideal client as someone that's like in it for the long haul. It's not that life changing for them. So that's really opened up our eyes to, you know, underwrite awesome deals that everyone's happy to own. And when we build these things, they're high end. I mean, like, our materials are longevity driven. So all of our like rain screens for the system, all the flashing, like, we go the extra mile because we're going to hold it forever.
You said something so important. You mentioned the avatar of a partner. Here's 100 grand. You're in your lane. I trust you. Go do it. Versus the other guy who wants their money. They're a boss who wants their money in 12 months. Do you want a partner? Do you want a boss?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you hit your earn out?
We haven't ran it yet because we have a couple renewals that I'm going to wait for the sun to come out.
I'm asking selfishly because I know that means I'll get a check.
Me too. I'm excited for that.
This is where the relationship really hits the road.
He knows.
Do I really like you or do I really, really like you?
I don't need the 100 back, but I do need some money.
I do need the 100 back.
Trevor's deal's failing. Needs Gabe to bail him out with an earn out on a past project.
Yeah, we've got some bleeders.
That's funny.
All right, so we're going to wrap this up in just a little bit, but you talked a bit about how every deal you ever sold, you always wished you hadn't. Like, so tell us a little bit more about like the feeling you get when you sell something and putting that money in your pocket, and then you pay taxes and you've got that money. Why forever hold? Like, you talked about bringing in investors who are fine to put the money in, leave it in long term. What is it about that drives you to say, I want to be a long term hold guy? I want to bring on partners and investors who are okay with the long term model. And why wasn't that money? Why the money that you put in your pocket after the sale? Why didn't that juice you more?
I think it's slowly became my thesis, is because you need active income to do the game right. When you don't, you make decisions based on needing
money. Yeah.
You let good things go.
Desperation.
And if that's just a principle of, I make my money here and I spend my money here, you're going to make very sound decisions, I feel like. And it sounds good on paper, and it's not always that in reality. And there's great windfalls you can have, like selling a primary, you know, residence. Like, it's great. But I also believe that if you are working hard to build up a vehicle to make you money, then you can make better decisions buying and holding and operating than you would being forced out of deals. Like, we had a project that I just felt very needed to sell, and I didn't like that feeling at all. You know, when you're pinched and you're just feeling like, man, this is not where I want to be.
Position of weakness instead of a position of strength.
Yeah. And I just think real estate's a game of control if you play it right. And like I was saying, where I was out of control with that lender, if we would have just started the process earlier or prepped our clients, like, it just, you have control. You just sometimes don't realize it. And so you need to be able to take a step back, make sure that you're making the decisions to fit your long-term. So I think for me, I would have held everything. That first house that I got sued on for that stupid waterproofing thing, maybe I would have got rid of because it's a single family house. And I don't necessarily believe in holding single family houses. I think that in those cases, that's an avenue to make money. It's like a flip, you know, if flipping's your active income. Yeah. Like, that's absolutely the business, but the value that someone's willing to pay for it so far exceeds, you know, the performance of the asset. It just kind of flips the table a bit. And I'd rather just get those out of my face and work on assets that I know fully top to bottom.
How do you know if something qualifies to be trading stock versus forever hold? Is there a, you know, house becomes a duplex, fourplex, so on and so forth. You finally get to 50 doors or 100 doors. Do you say, well, that's it. Like, that's what we were trying to do. And now we go try to take another house and take it up to 100 doors. Or is there a certain door count or a certain metric that you look at that you decide this is something that we want to sit on long term versus something that we need to?
I think because of my construction background and I get drawn to like the components of the product itself. When I walk projects that are, you know, great deals and I see things, I'm just like, oh, my stomach turns. You know, I know what's going to happen on this foundation. I know what's going to happen with the siding and the way they waterproof the trim and just stuff like that, that I'm just like, yeah, it's going to be great for a couple years, but you're going to just get hit. I know you will. And I just, so I look at very few single family deals I would even consider holding. I think they're better used for the homeowner. And I think they should be dealing in that avenue. And then multifamily, I think duplexes are wonderful. And that's how I've got here is duplexes. However, I wouldn't target those at the stage that I'm in now, only because of my expertise in the bigger stuff. Like, I'm just looking at them all the time now. If I'm back in my old days looking at just those, like, those are my target. And I think that's great. But it's whatever you're most comfortable with and like most getting the most reps with. So for me, I'm getting the most reps with bigger projects.
What do you mean by reps?
I'm underwriting those more. I'm just understanding them more. If I was to go look at, hey, if you said go buy 4 single family homes, I'd feel like a fish out of water. I have to go start from scratch and understand the market. And I don't know that space right now. So I think that it's very wise that, you know, for me, if I would have stopped at the 16 units or whatever I had, just me and my wife before I started doing partnerships and stuff. That could have been a very great situation all around. I think everyone should strive for that. But if I had desires past the 16, I don't think it's worthwhile to chase the same product that I was chasing for the 16. Mm-hmm. It's just too much. And especially the timing now, like if I wanted to do what I did now in this market, it wouldn't work. Absolutely not. You know, we're getting deals at 100 grand a unit, you know, on these duplexes with garages. And that was realistic with good marketing. It's not realistic now and rates are terrible. And because I was a loan officer, all my debt is like at sub 4, you know? So it's just different and those are great deals now, but.
So the debt may change, skew your holding pattern. You may go longer hold because it has such great debt on it.
Yeah, and I'm going to hold my stuff. I've put enough money into it now, but I don't have any single family, none. So,
but eventually, something on there, your duplexes will become trading stock because you got your eyes set on bigger stuff. Yeah. So, for those listening that are wanting to work a normal job, build a nice retirement, having something like 16 doors could build you a quite wonderful life. But
absolutely,
if you are mentally ill like us and you become a deal junkie, well, that's just not going to cut it. You're going to want to sell one of those duplexes and
if it's math driven and you know by getting out of this,
make more on the next one.
You like the next one more, but I wouldn't advise selling them and buying dirt. I think
sell an income stream to buy a debt service.
People do that, and it's a scary game.
Dirt just doesn't cash flow.
It's amazing how much dirt is taken out a qualified investor.
Big time. Yeah,
doesn't even have a structure to fall on.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well. Is that any other questions from you guys before we wrap it up? Mark, we really appreciate you joining us today on this podcast. It's been a special couple of episodes with you. We hope everybody is enjoying this podcast. We're sure having a lot of fun recording it for you. And we look forward to stepping in here every week and asking these silly questions and laughing about real estate. So we look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks for joining us again on Deal Junkies.
Yeah.